welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is External Messaging Client for the Service Integration Bus in WebSphere Application Server. Today's presenter is Rich Monjoy, which has been supporting IBM messaging products since 1998, starting with WebSphere MQ, which is formerly known as MQ Series, and has been supporting the Service Integration Bus since its release with WebSphere Applications version 6. His primary responsibility is working directly with customers to resolve technical issues related to the Service Integration Bus and interfacing with the Level 3 support team and development team. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Rich.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this WebSphere Technical Exchange on External Clients for the Service Integration Bus. First, we'll take a look at our agenda on slide 2, please, Joseph. We'll start off by looking at what is meant by the messaging clients and the available external clients for the Service Integration Bus. We'll then discuss what makes up a Service Integration Bus and review the JNDI configuration and some simple sample code. Then we'll take a look at each of the clients in more depth and look at the setup for each, how to enable tracing if you run into a problem you can't sort out, and then show an example of the application running. Slide 3, please. What is meant by an external messaging client? So what I mean by an external client is that it runs in its own JVM rather than the WebSphere application server JVM. These can run on the same physical server as the application server or on another physical server on the network. Slide 4, please. The external clients are a bit confusing for folks, which is what I'm trying to clear up some with this presentation. They're even at times confusing to us in support, as it is frequently difficult to determine from conversation with customers which client they're using. Many times they don't know or not sure, or whoever set it up previously has gone, and they just know it's a client of some sort coming into the bus. But it's important to realize that each requires a different setup, and each has different names and even nicknames and different tracing configurations. But we'll see that they can all use the exact same JMS application code, unmodified. The thin application client is installed with WebSphere application client with the WebSphere application client installation. The J2SE client, or affectionately the portly client, is strictly a SIB JMS client available via a separate download with V6, but now actually ships with WebSphere 7. The portly nickname is really misleading since it has the smallest footprint of any of these clients. And I suppose since we already had the thin and the thick clients, they wanted to keep a similar sort of nickname. The J2EE thick client is also installed with WebSphere application client and runs in the client container, which we'll talk about a bit later about what that means. Keep in mind that WebSphere application clients, thick and thin, can run Java programs as well as JMS, where the portly client is strictly a JMS client. And we're going to focus on the JMS side of these clients. Finally, we'll talk about the XMS client, which is not a JMS client at all, but rather a C++ client that can connect to SIB while pretending to be a JMS client. Slide 5, please, just. Now we'll spend some time reviewing some terminology. The Service Integration Bus is the default Java message service provider with WebSphere 6 and later. This is a change from WebSphere Application Server V5, where Embedded MQ, which was a scaled-down version of WebSphere MQ, was the default provider. SIB is compliant with the latest Java message service spec and offers several levels of message persistence. It supports both publish, subscribe, and point-to-point messaging domains, and is scalable, meaning it's capable of load balancing and high availability configurations. And it's written purely in Java, where the previous default JMS provider in WAS 5, Embedded MQ, was written in C. Slide 6, please. What makes up a bus? The bus itself is really just the entity where applications connect to send or receive messages, and can be thought of as one or more message engines. A message engine, or ME, is the runtime component of the bus. Each bus will have one or more bus members. Bus members are either standalone application servers or a cluster of servers. And when you add a bus member to a bus in the admin console or even through scripting, it creates a message engine for you. So each bus needs to have a bus member so that it has at least one message engine. And a bus with no bus member has no use because there is no message engine. Keep in mind a bus can have one or more MEs. So applications connect to the bus, which provides messaging functionality by attaching to destinations to send or receive messages. These destinations are defined to the bus. Also, each message engine has a message store, which is where we persist our data. In version 6, it defaulted to use CloudScape as the message store, but with 6.1 and later, it defaults to use a file store, which is just a couple of files on disk. You can, of course, configure a proper database like DB2 or Oracle for the message store. Okay, slide 7. Provider endpoints are particularly important to understand with clients. External clients are not able to determine which message engines are defined to the bus or where they're located. They need a bootstrap server to tell them this. A bootstrap server is just any application server running the SIB service. And this SIB service is simply the component that manages the inbound connection requests from external clients. So the bootstrap server is any server in the cell running the SIB service that may host a message engine, but it doesn't have to. Also, this SIB service can be enabled in the admin console under app servers, server name, and there's a little tab for SIB service, or not a tab, but a click for SIB service on the right side. Provider endpoints are configured on the JMS connection factory and tell the client where the SIB service is running, and this SIB service keeps track of where the message engines are running. These provider endpoints are specified in the triplet form of hostname, port, transport chain, where hostname is the name of the host running the SIB service and defaults to localhost. Port is the port number for the SIB bootstrap server, which defaults to 7276, and this is the port for the SIB endpoint address, which we'll see in a slide or two, I think. Transport chain is the channel used to send the bootstrap request to the bootstrap server. And the two chains I'll mention here are bootstrap basic messaging, which is non-SSL, and bootstrap secure messaging, which uses SSL for an encrypted connection. Keep in mind, you can have multiple provider endpoints specified in your connection factory, which we'll see the provider endpoints when we look at our JNDI config. So if one server that typically hosts the SIB service is offline, the client can then go to the next provider endpoint entry and try another server on the list. It's recommended to keep a fairly small number of highly available servers in your provider endpoint list. There's an APAR worth mentioning, PK58698, that provides a custom property to configure how long a client waits to try another server if the first is not available. And I think it defaults to 60 seconds. I think this went into 61017 and 60227. But again, that APAR number is PK58698. Slide number 8, please. Here we just have a screen capture of the ports listed in the admin console. And it's important not to confuse bootstrap address with the SIB bootstrap server. In WebSphere, an initial context for a name server is tied with a bootstrap host and bootstrap port. These two values are essentially the address of the name server, owning the initial context. So to get the JNDI initial context, you have to know the bootstrap host and port for the initial context name server. This is what's specified in the provider URL. So it's sort of like getting a redirectory. We'll see this when we look at the application code in a couple of slides. Notice the server listed at the top is server 1. As we'll see later on, server 1 is not even a member of the bus. But that's okay. We could use this server to get the initial context info we wanted as long as it's in the same cell as the bus. The SIB endpoint address and SIB endpoint secure address are the ports to find the SIB service. So again, what you use for the transport chains on the provider endpoints. As mentioned, the SIB endpoint address uses non-SSL secure socket layer channel, and SIB endpoint secure address would be used if you have configured the proper SSL repositories and certificates for an SSL connection. Slide number 9, please. Here we have a screenshot from the admin console that shows our JMS administered objects we'll be using configured in JNDI. We have a connection factory called JMS Client CF that points to bus 1, which is a bus I previously defined with server 2 as a bus member. Then we have a JMS queue defined called the JMS client queue, pointing to an actual destination defined on bus 1 called Q1. Slide number 10, please. In JMS, applications that send messages are producers. Applications that receive messages are consumers. And what I'm going to show here is just a simple sample of producer. This unmodified source can be used for each of the JMS clients, and one of the things I wanted to stress here, for the three clients we'll look at today, the Java clients, we can use the same unchanged source for each. You'll notice the highlighted context provider URL, which is what we talked about earlier regarding the Bootstrap host and port to get the WebSphere initial context. There are two ways to specify this. Both of the URLs listed would establish an IOP connection, but the first one that's commented out is using legacy syntax. And IIOP is just a lower level protocol by which the client does ORB or RMI, remote method invocation stuff. All you really need to know about that. The new core below URL allows more information to be provided in the URL, including failover information. So we could specify more than one server for the provider URL if we're using that core below option. So it's similar to what you can do with provider endpoints. You can specify multiple comma-separated core below URLs to ensure you have a running server. And that pretty much exhausts my knowledge of core below and IOP. Slide number 11, please. This source is fairly portable, as we're not using SIB-specific code here, but rather generic JMS interfaces in the JavaX naming import. We could have written this code to use SIB-specific classes. For example, I'm using JMS Connection Factory and JMS Destination, but this would require us to import the SIB JMS jars, which I had a little comment on in the previous slide. So if you did use the SIB-specific classes, you could then set provider endpoints programmatically, but then that makes the program less portable, which we don't want. If we wanted to make this uber portable, we could have specified the provider URL and the initial context as command line parameters for each of the clients. But I wanted to show the syntax here, but I'll show you later on what I mean by that for the command line options to set those. And highlighted in red are the objects we have previously defined in JNDI. Slide number 12, please. Here we just have the exception handling. I won't spend a lot of time on this. I just included it for completeness, so you have the entire code. And again, you want to cut and paste this out of the presentation and use it, feel free to. Slide number 13, please. Okay, we'll just backtrack a little bit over our agenda. At this point, we have covered what is meant by an external messaging client, what makes up a bus, our JNDI config, and the source we're going to be using. Now we'll move on to take a little bit longer look at each of the clients. Slide 14, please. When you install the WebSphere application client, you get both the thick and the thin client. They're essentially the same code. The thin client is considered more lightweight because it does not use the J2E services provided by the client container. And we'll talk a little bit more about the client container later on when we look at the thick client. It supports SSL and JNDI lookups and uses the RMI IOP protocol. It contains no JDBC classes, so if you want to access a database directly from this client, you'll need to add these JDBC classes from the vendor to your class path of the application. And they tell you that in some detail in the Info Center. Not going to spend a lot of time talking about the install of the application client because I don't think I could do a better job than what's in the Information Center. It's pretty well documented in the links above and worked painlessly for me. I just ran the Launchpad script off the WAS server install image and followed the prompts. So it was pretty painless. Slide number 16, please. Here's what you get from the install. From a SIB standpoint, the plugins directory contains the SIB jars. There's going to be a com.ibm.ws.sib.client with a version number .jar and a com.ibm.ws.sib.utils with a version number .jar. And I've got the installation directories listed there where it defaults to. Slide number 17, please. So the application client can be installed on any standalone server or on a server with WebSphere Application Server installed. You don't really need to worry much about the directory contents, as there are scripts provided to set up the environment. If the client is installed on a separate box from WAS, then run the setup CMD line from the bin directory in the app client install directory. If you're running the client in the same box as the server, then you run the setup CMD line script from the app server bin directory. The script just sets up a bunch of environment variables for you that should shield you from having to know much about any of that WAS environment stuff. So it does all that for you. Remember, on Unix, you need to source the script. Not sure the Info Center actually mentions this, but there is a tech note on that. And that's that option up at the top where I mentioned it. Just so you know, the AMAIX4 is just a name of one of our servers in the labs here. Slide 18, please. The thin client has many command line parameters to set up the runtime environment. Some are required, some are optional. It is recommended from support to include the full set as described in the Info Center and links listed. Otherwise, you might get into a trial and error situation trying to work out what you need and what you don't need. We'll see some of these in a bit. Slide number 19, please. Tracing is a big diagnostic tool for support, so it's important to understand how to trace the various clients. For the thin client, you use a tracesettings.properties file with the trace string and path to the trace output file specified in that properties file. Then just place this properties file somewhere in your class path. I put it in the same directory as the JMS client I ran. And here's an example of the entries I used on the full and a link to the Info Center giving more details on tracing. But again, it comes with that tracesettings.properties file, and you just edit it, put in the string you want and where you want the output file, and should be ready to go. Slide number 20, please. Now, I mentioned that you should include the full list of parameters, but I must confess I didn't use all the command line arguments listed in the URL as I was running into a space issue with the slide. You can see what I used here. Again, the plugins directory contains the SIB jars, and very important, to include the JRE lib ext directory for the -d java.ext dir system property. From the outputs, you can see the JMS client application we looked at previously run successfully, and these are just the outputs from the system out print lines. The highlighted output is just the two-string output on the JMS queue. So the connection factories looked up in JNDI, where the bus name, bus 1, is specified, with the JMS queue, which points to Q1. Also, we could have specified the provider URL and the initial context on the command line with -d JVM system properties, as I mentioned earlier when we were looking at the source code. The syntax for that is in the Info Center under a section called Running Thin Application Clients. Slide 21, please. Here I just wanted to give you an idea of what the trace looks like and just picked a few lines to include which show some of the interaction with the JMS objects you were using and the actual bus name and destination configured and the app server running the message engine server 2. Give me a second to look at that. Slide 22, please. At this point, before we complete the thin client discussion, I should mention the pluggable client, which is similar to the thin client, but runs only on Windows. The pluggable client does not include a JVM, and typically this would be used if you want to use a Sun JRE. We don't get too many calls on this, so I'm not sure how much it is used. But these links will give you details if you're interested. So when you hear pluggable client, just think thin application client for Windows using a Sun JRE. Slide 23, please. So now we come to the J2SE client, also known as the portly client. Again, a bit of a misnomer, the portly client is a smaller code base than the thin client we previously looked at. And it is strictly a JMS client, but like the thin client, does not use services provided by the client container, hence the name J2SE Standard Edition client as opposed to J2EE or JEE Enterprise Edition client. This client connects to SIB in WAS 6.0.2 or later or any IBM product that incorporates the service integration bus at that level or later. It's available for download from AlphaWorks at the listed URL, and also shipped with WAS 7. It would be in the runtimes directory in WAS 7. The version, and it contains some extra functionality for EJBs, the V7 version does. And so that increased the size a bit. It was originally, I think, around 3 megs, and now it's up to about 25 megabytes, but it's still much smaller than the thin client even. So to summarize, it's a standalone JMS client designed to run on an external JRE, very simple to use, and a fairly small footprint. Slide 24, please. So when you download the J2SE client, you'll get a jar with a name something like sibc_install some build number .jar. Then you just install with the options you want. JMS only, or as I have done, JMS with JNDI support. Keep in mind there are separate installs for IBM and Sun JREs. And there's even a separate image, I think, for OEM vendors use that you can download as well. Slide 25, please. Here is a directory of what is installed. Some scripts to assist with setup. I didn't use them. Feel free to. The documentation includes a getting started.html in the docs directory. Pretty good at discussing the scripts, the install, etc. The FC directory has the default client key stores if you want to use the SSL setup. And it actually shows the getting started.html shows the -d system properties for setting the SSL config. And I did a WSDI last year on the SSL config of the Portly client, if anyone's interested in that. I just thought I'd mention it. It should be available off the WSDI link still. The lib directory contains the sib jars. Then you have the license file and trace properties file, which we'll get to in a bit. Slide 26, please. Here are the sib jars with the Portly client located in the lib directory. The IBM JREs already contain the IBM org jar, where the Sun jars don't have this. So the Sun install of the client will include the sib orb jar in the lib directory. The orb jars should only be needed to be included in the class path if you're using a Sun JRE. And I have run into a few PMRs, though, dealing with IBM products which use the Portly client, I think such as Message Broker, and their install actually uses an IBM JRE on Sun that didn't include the orb jar. So just keep in mind, if you see issues at compile time with a message referring to missing a orb, you might want to check your class path to see if you have the orb and confirm which JRE you're using. Also, it's important to make sure not to include other WAS or MQ jars in your class path with the Portly client, as you might get some conflicts with the SIB classes. Slide 27, please. Trace is pretty easy on the Portly client. You just use the -d Java system property. The getting starting document I mentioned previously shows this pretty well. Here again, we're just reinforcing that we're using the same unmodified application as we did with the thin client. So you can see from looking at that command line there that we're just setting the trace string in the output file like we did with the thin client. Slide 28, please. I just picked the Portly client for no particular reason to go take a look in the admin console on the server side to take a look at a message. You can view our messages in the admin console, but it does involve more than just a few clicks of the mouse. It's buried down in there, but you can view the message. If you notice, we record the timestamp we receive the message, and also the state at the top is important. It's normal for a message to be in a locked state temporarily, but it shouldn't stay in a locked state. If you refresh your browser a few times and the message stays in a locked state, you might want to make sure you're up to snuff maintenance-wise, as there have been some APARs in this area. Slide 29, please. Also, the message ID and system message ID are very useful for issues where you're not sure where your message went. With these, we can track a message with SIB message trace enabled. And the last bit appended at the end of the system message ID is just an internal tick used by the message engine, so you don't need to really worry about what that is. Slide 30, please. Apologies, this trace snippet is jammed in here, but this is all I could fit, and I wanted to try and get in as much as I could. In a full trace output, these lines would be separated by other trace entries, but I tried to pick out some interesting ones. And we start off with the header, which shows the class path and trace string used. and I just selected a few entries from the trace to give you an idea of what's included. You can see we found the JMS client queue and JNDI and resolved it to Q1 on bus 1. Then we make a bootstrap request to see where the ME is running, and it happens to be server 2, and then we send our message. Slide, I'll give you a minute to look at that. Slide 31, please. I thought that for one of the clients I would take a look at a simultaneous server-side trace. As with client connection problems, you typically want to trace both sides. So I picked a poor lead to do this. Here we have the trace log off the server side using SIB message trace. You'll notice in red is the message ID we saw in the admin console screen capture on slide 21. Ditto with the system message ID in blue. Pretty easy to see if you're having problems determining where your message is, that this can help. And this wraps up our discussion of the J2SE, a.k.a. Portly client. Slide 32, please. Now we're going to talk about the J2E or thick client. The thin and the thick clients are really the same animal, except that the thick client runs in the client container. But what does that really mean? There are various containers in the JEE world. There's web, EJB, and application client containers. These containers are just the infrastructure or the runtime support for a component. J2EE, or JEE as it's known now, is a specification that requires support for these containers. For example, a web container hosts web applications, so we're talking serverless and JSPs. EJB container provides local and remote access to EJBs. A client container runs standalone Java applications, known as JEE, application clients, and provides J2E services to the applications. Examples of these services are simple JNDI lookups, where the container can look up EJB references, and security, where the container handles security authentication for you, so you don't have to worry about that in your application. So this client container simply hosts JEE client applications and provides a runtime support for these clients. The services provided by the client container are supposed to make it easier to develop applications and make them more portable. In WAS, WAS for Application Server, J2EE applications are kicked off using the launch client script, which sets up the runtime environment with the required class path. Slide 33, please. Again, we won't talk much about the install, as it's the same as the thin client. Remember, when you install the application clients, you get both of them, the thin and the thick. There are the links there that, you know, a lot of information there if you're planning the install and then the actual install. Slide 34, please. The launch client script is going to want our client application to be packaged as an IR file, which is Enterprise Archive File. There's an assortment of tooling available for this, such as IBM Rational tooling, but I chose Eclipse for no specific reason. WAS version 6.1 and below included the AST, or Application Assembly Tool, which was a scaled-down version of RAD to package applications, but I believe this has been removed in version 7. I probably should have included the URL for Eclipse. I just realized that's missing. It's www.eclipse.org, and the tool is called Ganymede, G-A-N-Y-M-E-D-E. And it's a free download. I don't really want to turn this into an Eclipse tutorial, so here's just a summary of the steps I use. So in Eclipse, you create a new application client project. You make sure to check Add Client Project to an IR under the IR membership at the bottom of the page. You drag your source code over under App Client Module Default Package. You make sure you include the WAS J2E jars in your build path, as I've listed. Then make sure your manifest MF file points to your application and not the default main class. And it's a good idea to make sure you're using the 5.0 Java version. Then export the IR by clicking File at the top left and then Export. Slide 35, please. I just want to give you an idea of what the Eclipse panel looks like. You can see the JMS client on the left side, and the J2E jar is listed because I added it, as I mentioned in the previous slide. A portion of the JMS client source is visible that we've been looking at, and didn't have to do anything with the deployment descriptor because this is just a really basic client. Slide 36, please. As you can see in this third client we're discussing, tracing is set up a bit differently again. it's enabled with the dash CC parameter, which I guess is for client container. And there are many of these dash CC parameters, but we're only focusing on the ones for tracing right now. But if you look at that provided URL, you can see the complete list of them. So again, we're just essentially talking about a trace string and an output file. So pretty simple with an example, which we'll see next. Slide 37, please. Here's an example of running the exported ear with the launch client. And the same output we have seen with the other clients. Notice launch client requires you to set the provider URL on the command line for the client container. It will ignore the one we have set in our application, but you have to set that on the command line with the thick client. I should mention both the portly and the thin client, again, will allow you to set the provider URL in the initial context with a dash D JVM system property. I just want to reinforce that to make it as portable as can be. It's not much of a J2E application as we're not doing anything with Enterprise Beans on the server, but we could do another WSDI just on the J2E client because it can get pretty involved. Slide 38, please. Here we have the trace output showing our JNDI destination and the server we're talking to, server 2, and at the bottom our message text we sent. And this completes our discussion on the J2E client. So slide 39, please. Now we're going to talk a little bit about a different animal. This is the XMS client. The full name is the IBM Message Service Client for C and C++. It's a non-Java client that allows C or C++ applications to work with JMS messages. It supports both publish-subscribe and point-to-point messaging domains and provides support for SSL and JNDI lookups as the other JMS clients we talked about do. And it's available via a WebSphere MQ support pack, but also ships with some other WebSphere products. I think it's included with Process Server as one of those. And there's also a .NET version of this client as well. It's called IA9H from the same MQ support pack page I should probably mention as well. Slide 40, please, sir. So the XMS client follows the JMS model. So you get a connection factory, which is just a template for connections, and a connection object, which is the physical connection to the messaging provider. And the session object is the context for producing and consuming messages, and the destination object is the queue or topic space which you're sending to or receiving from. So very JMS-y here. Slide 41, please. The install is via a setup program which will prompt you through some screens which I've included a summary of. You get a welcome panel that prompts you to accept a license. If you want GSKit support for SSL, there's an option there. There are also an option for different custom installs. You can install various parts of this client. Slide 42, please. The XMS client is kind of neat because it includes many C and C++ samples, both source and compiled versions of producers and consumers. And I included here on this foil where these are located. So on Unix, we're talking OptimQM, XMS, Tools, Samples, Bin. And Windows, it's under Program Files, IBM XMS Tool Samples Bin. Slide 43, please. For the XMS client, you have to configure an environment variable depending on the platform. So it's libpath on Linux and Solaris, and LD library path on AIX, and these need to point to the install lib directory. On Windows, the install bin directory needs to be in your path. I think LD library path will work on AIX, but I haven't tested it. The install instructions or the documentation tells you to set the LD library path, or the lib path, I should say, will work on AIX, but the documentation points to LD library path. Slide 44, please. We have two methods to enable trace with the XMS client. The first is an interactive method based off the PID of the XMS program. The second is via use of environment variables where you can set the trace level, the location of the output file, and size before it wraps, and then the number of trace files. In both cases, trace by default is written to the current working directory. Slide 45, please. So I just picked one of the samples here. This is a C++ sample producer. If anyone's familiar with the WebSphere MQ sample program, MQIVP, It's very similar to that. You launch the program, and it steps you through some prompts. As you can see, it defaults to WPM, which is Web Server Platform Messaging, which is another term for SIB, for the connection type. If my messaging provider was MQ, then I would just put in WMQ. Then it asks me for the provider endpoints, which is, as we discussed, just point to the server in the cell running the SIB service. Then the transport chain, which is the channel for the connection to the ME, and the bus name and the destination in URI form. And finally, our message text. Slide 46, please. Here's the sample output. I think my year of birth is just trying to show a use of the message property down at the bottom there. Slide 47, please. And here we're going to finish up with taking a look at some trace output. It looks a little bit different than the JMS traces we looked at previously, but we can still see the header information and the connection factory objects, etc. And that wraps up our discussion of the XMS client. Slide 48, please. So in summary, we reviewed what is meant by a messaging client and a service integration bus, the components of a bus, a pretty lengthy discussion of provider endpoints, and then showed how some JMS objects we defined in JNDI are accessed by a JMS client by JNDI lookups. We then went over each of the clients, took a look at the setups needed for each, including tracing, and reinforced the notion that a single unmodified JMS app can be used for each client. And finally, we concluded with the XMS client, and we looked at the install, setup, provided sample, and tracing for that as well. Hopefully, if you were unfamiliar with the client options for SIB, this has clarified the options for you a bit. Then take a look at some of them in further depth. Slide 49, please. Here we have some useful links to the SIB MustGather, the Service Integration Bus MustGather. So if you're having problems, that's a good first place to look. Then there's also a problem determination redbook on JMS, which is also a good reference. The System Management and Config redbook has a lot of admin stuff for WebSphere application server, but it does include sections on the application client and the service integration bus. And of course, you have the info center and then the main WebSphere support page. Slide 49, please. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Developer Works offers in-depth technical information. The events link on the support pages points you to a webcast and conference information. Visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up and running quickly. The ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Support link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. And I'll turn it over to Joseph.
Thank you, Rich, for a great presentation. At this point, Kathy, we would like to open the line for questions.
Jerry Wagaman, you may ask your question.
In particular, I'd like to know if there's any licensing issues to be able to make use of the jars and bind them in the thin client that we plan to use.
I know there aren't any licensing restrictions if you have the OEM version of the Portly, but with the thin, I'm not 100% sure on that.
Thank you.
At this time, I show no further questions.
Thank you, Kathy. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.